The sea is calm tonight, the tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the strait.
Now it is time to take longer strides. Time for a great new American enterprise. Time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth.
The commitment came from John F. Kennedy in May of 1961, a pledge that American astronauts would set foot on the moon by 1970. But it's only part of the story, part of the sound. The superstition, the romance, and above all, the curiosity of man and the moon. Most scientists believe that man has lived on Earth for about 1 million years. He has spent most of that time in awe of the moon. For pre-Neanderthal man, it was his only source of light during the long night, but also something to be regarded with superstition and fear. As the history of man unfolds, the moon becomes the lair of evil and then of deities. The Egyptian god Thoth, it is written, won part of the moon's light and with it created 5 extra days. The Greek goddess Diana lived on the moon, as did the Babylonian god Sin, who flew through the night, foiling evildoers with his light. Since the dawn of recorded history, the moon has been of singular influence to man's civilization and culture. The lunar light has cured warts, turned men into werewolves, determined the proper time to plant, harvest, fish, fight battles, court a girl, marry, and so forth. The moon has also been a proper subject for the young'uns. Nobody knows when the children first recited those nursery rhymes or sang the first songs, "Hey diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle," or "Hand in hand on the edge of the sand they danced by the light of the moon." And there still exists those curiously American old wives' tales. A maiden who drinks white wine and rose water and looks through a silk scarf at the moon will see her husband-to-be. Or, if a husband leaves his wife while the moon is waning, he will not be seen by her again. But somewhere beyond superstition, and short of curiosity, was the moon's inspiration for poets.
Swear not by the moon, the inconstant moon that monthly changes in her circled orb, lest that thy love prove likewise variable.
Whenever the moon and stars are set, whenever the wind is high, all night long in the dark and wet, a man goes riding by.
It is the very error of the moon. She comes more near the earth than she was wont, and makes men mad. That orbed maiden with white fire laden, whom mortals call the moon.
By the 17th century, man has the imagination, but not the wherewithal, to get to the moon, and so he writes. Cyrano de Bergerac takes a lunar trip aboard a chariot powered by firecrackers. Years later, as the hero of Rostand's play, Cyrano contrives 6 ways to get there. For example, sit on an iron plate, hurl a magnet into the air, the iron follows, catch the magnet, throw again, and so proceed indefinitely. In 1638, the hero of Godwin's Man in the Moon is towed there by 25 swans. In 1835, the celebrated moon story describes the forest and the mountains, the tailless beavers and human-like lunar quadrupeds as seen in the moon with a powerful telescope. It's all published as a series by the New York Sun as exclusive scientific information, but is in reality a hoax. Then in 1865, Jules Verne writes From the Earth to the Moon. His launching is from Florida. Three astronauts who find the moon a dreary, inhospitable place and a splashdown in the Pacific where they are picked up by an American ship. It proves to be frighteningly accurate, except for the launching. Verne uses an atomic cannon, but the real source has been developed more than 600 years before. They are described in 1232 AD as arrows of flying fire, and the Chinese make them from the gunpowder they have invented. They are called rockets. In the 1600s, Johannes Kepler, a German scientist, develops laws of planetary motion. Sir Isaac Newton uses Kepler's work as a base for his laws of motion. Law 3 states, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. It is the precise principle of rocketry. It is not until the 1800s, however, that Sir William Congreve of England develops the rocket into a long-range military weapon. It weighs as much as 60 pounds and carries explosives. These are the rockets that burst above Fort McHenry in the War of 1812, and seen by Francis Scott Key, are described in his Star-Spangled Banner. It is now 1903, and the population of the United States is approximately 76 million people. It's the year of Chicago's centennial, the formation of the Ford Motor Company, and the first plane flight by the Wright brothers. It is also the year that a Russian named Tsiolkovsky publishes the first scientific paper on the use of rockets for space flight. Over the next 16 years, two men work independently to attack the technical problems of rocketry and high-altitude research. In 1919, Robert Goddard of the U.S. publishes a paper explaining how rockets could be used to explore the upper atmosphere and describes a way of firing a rocket to the moon. 4 years later, in Germany, Hermann Oberth of Germany publishes a book describing a spaceship for interplanetary travel. There is such interest that a German Society for Space Travel is formed and leads eventually to the first successful guided missiles, the German V-2 rocket of World War II. After the war, Werner von Braun, a disciple of Oberth, comes to the U.S. to work. But post-war America is now a world power and too busy to worry about rocketry. There is some development. The whack corporal that can climb to a height of 30 miles but has no room for instruments, and then the Araby, which reaches 180 miles. The Navy develops the Viking, and Charles Jaeger flies faster than sound in the rocket-powered plane, the X-1. But it is Russia that opens the space age in 1957 with Sputnik 1, shattering the U.S. timetable for space, and the Soviets do it with a payload 10 times heavier than we had planned. Americans are shocked, and there's a great hue and cry in Congress for an investigation of the situation, now called the Space Gap. Here's WBBM News Radio science editor, Dr. Leonard Riefel.
We knew how to build, because we were ahead of the Russians in nuclear technology, we knew how to build hydrogen bombs for a given amount of explosive force that didn't weigh very much. The Russians, as you probably recall, got the hydrogen bomb not too long after we did. But they did it in a much more clumsy way. The things weighed a great deal more. So that when they had to build ICBMs, they had to build big rockets to get those clumsy weapons across the ocean. We, on the other hand, had lightweight bombs, comparatively. We could build small rockets. Now, that was fine for ICBMs, at least in the first generation. But what it did was it moved the Russians ahead of us in the lifting of big payloads into orbit, and you know what that meant in the early days of manned spaceflight.
With the launching of the Russian Sputnik 1 and the resulting hubbub by Congress, the Eisenhower administration makes some decisions toward getting the U.S. into the ballgame. A special assistant for science and technology is created to advise Ike, and a civilian agency is given management of the space effort rather than the military. The Soviets have already run up an impressive number of probes, including the first space traveler, a dog named Laika. It is not until 1958 that the first American satellite is blasted into orbit. The Explorer is followed by the Vanguard and the Pioneer series. And then in December, Project SCORE becomes the first communication satellite to broadcast a voice message from space. That voice belongs to Dwight Eisenhower.
This is the President of the United States speaking. Through the marvels of scientific advance, my voice is coming to you from a satellite circling in our space.
In 1959 and '60 see more communication satellite launchings, and we send a rocket to orbit the sun, but U.S. space commitment is still limited. The Russians, however, have hit the moon with an unmanned space shot and photographed the dark side of the moon with another. And in 1961, Yuri Gagarin of the USSR becomes the first man to orbit the Earth. In the U.S., there are unemployment and desegregation problems. Relations with Castro's Cuba grow worse until 5 days after Gagarin's flight, the anti-Castro forces attempt an invasion of the Cuban Bay of Pigs. It's a miserable failure. John F. Kennedy is the new president, and Americans need something for their morale. It is May 5th, 1961.
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff, and 34 minutes after the hour.
It's only a 15-minute suborbital flight, but Navy Commander Alan Shepard becomes the first American in space, 115 miles high and 302 miles downrange. We're in the manned space race, and it's something to cheer about.
Oxygen, go! All systems are go!
And now something to capture the imagination of the world. President Kennedy asks his advisors to find a space goal where the two nations, the U.S. and Russia, can start as equals, and where American technology could likely win. 126 days after becoming president, JFK goes before Congress with a special request.
I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities, to provide the funds which are needed to meet the following national goals. First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. We propose to accelerate the development of the appropriate lunar spacecraft. We propose to develop alternate liquid and solid fuel boosters, much larger than any now being developed, until certain which is superior. We propose additional funds for other engine development and for unmanned exploration, explorations which are particularly important for one purpose which this nation will never overlook: the survival of the man who first makes this daring flight. But in a very real sense, it will not be one man going to the moon. If we make this judgment affirmatively, it will be an entire nation, for all of us must work to put him there.
And Congress reacts enthusiastically. A moon landing becomes the national goal, setting into motion the greatest peacetime mobilization in U.S. history.
May the wee ones be with you, Thomas.
Good Lord, ride all the ways.
Amen.
T-minus 10 seconds, counting 8, 7, 6, 5, 4,
3, 2, 1, 0.
John Glenn becomes America's first man to orbit the Earth in February of 62, traveling at 17,500 miles per hour, crossing oceans and continents, going from daylight to darkness to daylight.
Fine, capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous.
The first phase of America's push to the moon, the Mercury series, ends in 1963 with Gordon Cooper making 22 revolutions of the Earth. Now it is time to learn something about man's ability in space. Can he endure, develop, and perfect the rendezvous techniques needed to make the moon trip work? That's the task of the Gemini series, two-man flights, 10 of them in all, in a 4-ton spacecraft. Virgil Grissom becomes the first American to make 2 space trips, and in Gemini 4, Ed White takes the first U.S. walk in space, while his partner, Jim McDivitt, gossips from the inside of the space capsule.
One thing about it, when Ed gets out there and starts wiggling around, it sure makes the spacecraft off the control.
Take some pictures.
Okay, I'm gonna work on getting some pictures, Jim.
Okay, get out of front where I can see you again.
Okay. Go slowly, I'll take your picture.
Other Gemini flights see Borman and Lovell set a 14-day space endurance record. There's a space rendezvous and then the first space docking. Through the Gemini series, astronauts prove that manned capsules can hook up to an orbiting rocket stage, then use its own fuel to maneuver from one to the other. Gemini also pioneers the controlled gliding returns into the Earth's atmosphere, something Apollo pilots will have to rely on. It is 1967 now, and in the nearly 6 years of America's manned space flights, there have been no loss of life mishaps as a direct result of the program. There have been some close calls. During John Glenn's flight, for example, when voice contact was lost, and then again when the heat shield burned up during Glenn's re-entry. And the Gemini 8 shot in 1966 when Armstrong and Scott latched onto that Agena. 27 minutes after docking, a faulty thruster sent the entire assembly into whirling gyrations, but the astronauts coolly activated an emergency control and separated from the Agena. Now, as Apollo, the third phase in America's manned space series, begins, the tragedy comes, not from space, but from the ground. It is February 21st, 1967.
Astronauts Virgil I. Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee were killed tonight in a flash fire during test of the Apollo Saturn 204 vehicle. The fire occurred while the astronauts were in the spacecraft during the countdown of a simulated flight test. The accident occurred at 6:31 Eastern Standard Time. Hatches on the spacecraft were closed. Emergency crews encountered dense smoke in removing the hatches. All data has been impounded, pending investigation.
Investigating teams pin the probable cause on an electrical short circuit, but they also find repeated examples of sloppy workmanship and inferior materials. The investigation results in a complete rebuilding of the Apollo program. Now designs are reevaluated, new fireproof materials are developed, and after 19 months and nearly $500 million, Apollo continues. In 1968, Apollo 7 performs in orbit for 11 days and performs better than hoped for. Out of the turmoil and the tragedy has come perfection. And now, it is time for Apollo 8, and man's first close-up look at the moon.